My name is Michael McCusker. Today is the bicentennial birthdays of two men who changed the world and who were born only minutes apart the same day, Abraham Lincoln and Charles Darwin, February 12, 1809. And the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, is either 100 years old today, according to National Public Radio, or it is 99 years old, according to other sources, that it was started today in 1910 rather than in 1909. And of course, February is Black History Month. And Saturday, which we waste as Valentine's Day, its true relevance is the 150th birthday of Oregon as a state of the United States. And it supported the Union during the Civil War, even though it deported all blacks earlier. And today on this program, we have a special guest, Walter Trumbull, who is engaged in putting together a one-person personification of Abraham Lincoln. And he has written a special Lincoln's birthday address that he has written and will be, as soon as I finish, my little rant. And I call mine The Emancipation of Abraham Lincoln. And I will start with a quote by Martin Luther King, Jr. "There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges." The Emancipation of Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln, the 16th President of the United States, is 200 years old today. He was born February 12, 1809, and was murdered on Good Friday, April 14, 1865, at the age of 56. He was shot in the back of the head while attending a stage play by an embittered actor who thought his single bullet would reverse the loss of a civil war just ended. For most of the world, Lincoln is the symbol of the United States. For Americans, his worn, gaunt, and terribly sad face is our conscience. He is revered as almost a saintly human being, and with Karl Marx, is probably the other most significant political figure of the 19th century, and certainly the most compelling in American history. Lincoln grew to power from poverty and obscurity. He was raised on the frontier and taught himself law. He is probably the nation's most successful politician. Just prior to his election as president, he was hardly known outside Illinois. At his inauguration in 1861, he was the most reviled man in the country, yet immediately after his death, he was regarded the most beloved. He almost single-handedly held the sundered Union to its successful and awesomely bloody purpose of defeating the secession of the Confederacy. More than almost any man of his era, he grew to understand the importance of the unity of the United States. Without unity, the nation would be the victim of other rapacious powers that wish to obliterate the fledgling split democracy and expropriate its vast spaces and incredibly rich resources. He passionately believed the doctrine of political freedom would disappear from the world if the U.S. dissolved. Ironically, his election as president severed the nation. And just as ironically, the division of the nation centered on the question of political and individual freedom of black slaves. Although Lincoln believed the gradual abolition of slavery was an historical inevitability and the intent of the majority of the framers of the American Constitution, his dramatic act of emancipation halfway through the Civil War, more than any other act, made him one of the most memorable and important figures in history. Lincoln had very little personal acquaintance with slavery, though he had witnessed it on the river landings of Missouri and southern Illinois, and in particular during his single term in Congress in Washington, D.C., which at that time, in the 1840s, was a major warehouse for the slave trade, by then illegal, but not slavery itself. He thought slavery violated the doctrine of equal rights, but he never quite abandoned the idea of white superiority. For most of his struggle against slavery, he did not believe that whites and blacks could coexist without economic dislocation and violence, and he preferred establishing colonies of former slaves in South or Central America in much the manner as Liberia in Africa. He was opposed to immediate emancipation and initially believed that slavery could be slowly and patiently eradicated without disunion. He thought a policy of containment by free states would eventually strangle slavery. The secession of the Confederacy altered his hopes. Though he still believed emancipation would lead to catastrophe and initially resisted radical abolitionists, he needed a strong, clear, driving force to continue support for the war against the Southern states to justify the intensifying bloodiness and appalling Union losses. He also wanted to instill terror in the South, which had always been haunted by the specter of a massive slave uprising. Yet he wished no revenge upon the South, unlike many Northern politicians and abolitionists, and his original plans for Reconstruction following the war gave no political power to the freed slaves in the defeated Confederacy, nor were they to be allowed to vote. Although he became convinced that blacks and whites would have to remain together because separatism was infeasible, he continued to believe the status quo had to change gradually if change was to be successful. It was his feeling that several generations would have to pass before blacks were capable and educated enough to assume political power. Their chances for economic freedom were nil, and it is probable he was also aware that sudden enfranchisement of power and wealth would result in a brutal backlash against blacks in both North and South. Lincoln might not have been able to prevent the opportunistic revenge upon the South, but his death ensured it. Its result was a counter-revenge, not upon the white carpetbaggers who infested the South at the end of the Civil War, but upon freed slaves who were terrorized and murdered. White supremacy groups grew up on the fringes of Southern anger, the most dominant and ruthless, the Night Riders of the Ku Klux Klan. Lynchings of blacks were commonplace following the Civil War and lasted until the seventh decade of the 20th century. After nearly a century and a half after emancipation, the United States has finally elected a black president. Yet, a decade into the 21st century, the overwhelming majority of American blacks are still without position or power, and all the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s dramatized and somewhat improved black prospects. The pervasive racism that continues to saturate American society strips away the few advances that have been achieved. American history is taught from primarily a white perspective, which is only a portion of our history, and without integrating it with black American history, it is irrelevant, and worse, it is a lie that perpetuates the racism that underlies and embitters our truly pluralistic history. African blacks and European whites were parallel colonizers of the Western Hemisphere, and together they built the civilizations that currently exist in North and South America. The primary difference is that black immigration was a forced migration. Millions of blacks were brought in chains from Africa as slaves for 400 years. Slavery evolved as the result of the need for an abundant and relatively cheap supply of labor in the American colonies, and the traffic in slaves was itself probably the most profitable international trade in history. Entire industries were built on the commerce of human slaves, and as cruel as it was, which induced an opaqueness to the torment inflicted by the trade, the extent and profitability of slavery built cities and helped raise the capital that started the Industrial Revolution in England. Much of Africa was emptied to provide slaves for the European colonies in the Americas, and most of Africa was colonized by European nations. Africans who were not sent across the oceans as slaves were enslaved at home. No one will ever know precisely how many millions of blacks were killed in their villages in four centuries of slave raids, but it is estimated that about one-third of those captures died en route to the coasts or while imprisoned awaiting embarkation, and another third aboard ships in which they were chained and stacked like cords of woods in overcrowded, filthy holds, and during the seasoning process of slavery, worked to death in stifling climates, beaten and murdered if they were slow to obey or attempted to escape. When the slave trade was finally declared illegal at the end of the 18th century, its illicitness made it even more profitable in much the manner as the current international drug trade. And as with illegal drugs, when capture is imminent, uncounted thousands of black men, women, and children were thrown overboard to drown in the ocean, chained together, whenever a naval patrol caught up with a slave ship. The trade was also profitable because it was easier to work a slave to death and buy a new one than it was to breed and feed newer generations, although that, of course, was also done. Slavery in the Americas took two separate directions. In the Spanish and Portuguese colonies in South and Central America, slavery continued the long tradition of Mediterranean slavery, practiced most famously in classical times, and was incorporated in the Iberian Catholic religious doctrine, which claimed that although slaves were of the lowest social order, both masters and slaves possessed souls that were regarded as equal by God. The tendency, therefore, was that slaves were human beings with some rights and some legal means by which they might achieve freedom. the legal structures of the North American colonies and the British West Indies, and later the United States, did not recognize slaves as human beings entitled to human rights. The ancient and medieval experiences with slavery had been forgotten, and Northern Europe did not have a comparable tradition with the Iberian nations. There was no slave law and no concern for blacks in their religious doctrines. More problematic for the future was the tendency of Northern Europeans and Americans to identify blacks with slavery. The mere fact of being black was presumptive of slave status. Slavery was considered perpetual, and chances of working toward freedom were few. To be black was to be a slave, without rights to marriage, children, whose value was only as prospective slaves, property, or to the product of their work. Southern slave society grew from the same historical conditions that produced the world's other slave regimes. The rise of a world market and the need for cheap labor encouraged slavery, and only the advent of mechanical technology and industrialism rendered it inefficient and ultimately incapable of competing in the very market that created it. The South was haunted by its guilt and fear of slavery. Enslaving blacks was justified through claims that it was God's intent that whites were superior to blacks, that slavery civilized blacks and elevated them above their former status as jungle savages, and that, in essence, whites were carrying out God's law by making slaves and Christians out of pagan blacks. In reality, southern plantations were battlefields where slaves fought masters for physical and psychological survival. And although they were unlettered, outnumbered, and unarmed, black slaves struggled in as many ways as they could to preserve their humanity against virtually inhuman odds. Southern whites bitterly resisted acknowledging the humanity of their black slaves, a contradiction of their claim of God's edict to Christianize them. Underlying their pious justifications was a terror of the system they had fabricated. The culture of the antebellum South was continually in dread of slave insurrection, and any outbreak was savagely suppressed. In a sense, a reason for perpetuating slavery was the fear of reprisal once it was abolished. Most Northern whites also considered themselves superior to blacks, and the desire to abolish slavery had more to do with its interference with paid labor than with human rights. Even a majority of the Northern abolitionists who had risked imprisonment and their lives providing underground systems of escape for runaway slaves felt, as Abraham Lincoln, that blacks should dwell apart from whites. Yet, ultimately, however intense the economic dialectics regarding slavery, and perhaps because the climate of industrialism allowed it, the most important reason for the abolition of slavery was the moral one. The idea of the inherent value of an individual outlasted slavery and was the chief source of its undoing. There were many reasons for the division of the young nation, South from North, but at its core was the inhumanity of slavery. Frank Tannenbaum, in his book Slave and Citizen, wrote that inherent in the history of slavery was an important contribution to the theory of social change. Wherever the law accepted the doctrine of the moral personality of the slave and made possible the gradual achievement of freedom implicit in such a doctrine, the slave system was abolished peacefully. Where the slave was denied recognition as a moral person and was therefore considered incapable of freedom, the abolition of slavery was accomplished by force, by violence and revolution. We cannot separate our history from the long centuries of slavery. Without black slaves from Africa, much of the Western Hemisphere would not have been converted into an enclave of European civilization. The fight for independence that characterized the American Revolution did not include liberty for slaves, and the oversight caused the Civil War 80 years later. Emancipation only brought a semblance of physical relief from slavery, but its underlying racialism has not been eradicated nearly a century and a half later. If the class system of slavery is defined by color, then a post-slavery society becomes a form of apartheid, which has been the result in the United States since the Civil War, and which was starkly dramatized in the violence unleashed against the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s. We begin the third millennium of our age still a divided nation, and as Lincoln said, though he was not the first to say it, a house divided will not long stand. Blacks as well as whites wish for separation, but there is really no other place to go. Just as whites are no longer Europeans, American blacks are not Africans anymore. For better or worse, blacks and whites are hybrid Americans. Slaves or free, the arduous, tragic, and unequal role of black Americans in building and defending the nation has always been devalued and generally ignored. Just as the word history seems to imply only male endeavor, his story, so does it imply Western European white dominance and supremacy over world affairs. Yet the black struggle for civic and social equality, especially in the last generation, has been the most inspiring and closest to the revolution of the Enlightenment that gave birth to the United States than any other. This struggle is a continuation of what Washington, Jefferson, Adams, et al. Started and unfortunately denied people of color, who were regarded as property rather than persons, born equal and certainly not born free. Lincoln's executive order of emancipation went into effect January 1, 1863. Though it abolished slavery in the Confederate states, though those not those under Union control, it was probably not legal according to U.S. civil law. To remedy any deficiencies in the proclamation in regard to its legal standing, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was introduced in Congress in 1864 and was ratified in 1865, the year the Civil War ended. It abolished slavery or involuntary servitude in the United States or anywhere under U.S. jurisdiction. The Emancipation Proclamation, though it raised the conflict for union to an issue of international moral principle, had little initial practical impact because Lincoln at the time had no authority in the Confederacy. Lincoln had proposed the proclamation the previous summer. Secretary of State Seward suggested he wait to announce it until a significant Union battlefield victory so that European governments would not misinterpret it as a final shriek in our retreat. And that's a quote from Seward. Lincoln had said at the start of the Civil War, "If I could preserve the Union by freeing all the slaves everywhere, I would do so. If I could preserve the Union by freeing none of the slaves, I would do so. If I could preserve the Union by freeing some of the slaves, I would do so." His critics and some supporters thought the proclamation was a cynical act by a weak, vacillating president. Yet by conceding to free the few, he struck to the heart of the conflict and never afterward wavered from his promise. He got his victory at Sharpsburg, Maryland on September 16, 1862, near a little creek and a church named after it that forever gave the battle its name, Antietam. The Union Army routed a Confederate invasion of the North. It was the single bloodiest day of the Civil War, at least 15,000 dead on both sides and another 20,000 wounded or missing. Union losses alone were twice as many as those of the Normandy D-Day landings 82 years later. 5 days after Antietam, Lincoln issued his proclamation. Quote, "On the first day of January 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall then be thenceforth and forever free." "If my name ever goes into history," Lincoln said, "it was for this act." Racism will only end when children of every race are taught early that the color of skin is far less than the equality of hearts and minds. That will not be easy. No less than the essential education system of the United States must be uprooted and rewritten to reflect the common struggle of both races to build and survive in this country. "We cannot escape history," Lincoln said to Congress. "We will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trail through which we pass will light us down, in honor or dishonor, to the latest generation." And that was something I wrote, The Emancipation of Abraham Lincoln. Now, Walter Trumbull here is dressed as Lincoln. He has the string tie, the dark coat. His hair is even the same, and he seems like he has the same hairline, and of course, the beard. And he has a special birthday address that he wrote. Go ahead, Walter.
Ladies and gentlemen of the United States Senate, the House of Representatives, my fellow citizens of the United States of America, and our new president, Mr. Barack Obama. Here, upon the steps of our great nation's capital, I have sat watching over the years and the passing generations. I have witnessed the little children, the sick and the weak, the elderly and the strong, climb these many steps and stand here with me. I have heard their prayers that God would one day heal this nation, I have listened and wept with them. Still, when they turn their gazes to those halls of justice, I know what lies therein. For it is, in truth, if history and our benevolent God were to judge us right here and now, the only justice to be found in those halls of justice is in the halls. The deceptions of lawyers and corrupt businessmen who fill those halls have for too many years now dealt the people a losing hand. Their silken sleeves and pockets lined with the taxpayers' money. The lies and corruption and malfeasance of these, our representatives, has shook loose the foundations of those halls and laid them down in silent fields of blood and money, our ransomed promised dream. To what end? I ask each of you, to what end? How do we benefit from this dishonor which visits us daily upon these sacred steps, where the bodies of hundreds of thousands of the innocent have been turned under in the name of one ill-conceived and ungodly war after another? How is it that we do these things? To save what union, I ask you, my esteemed colleagues? How can it benefit the justly governance of this or any nation by the enslavement of our own people, our brothers and sisters? How might it benefit for the good of all people, our greater effort to rise above our basest nature? Is it in our power to live peacefully, united in brotherhood? I believe we can. I believe it is God's only will for us. The oppression which slavery brought upon the conscience of the people in their republic has yet to be lifted. The weight and burden of a profiteering class of the few and mighty has left nearly broken the body of effort set forth in the Civil War. These few have usurped the very purpose of our founders for their narrow and criminally unconstitutional ends. These few have brought a tyranny of enslavement to our land far more than the South could have in 1,000 years done. This tyranny has too closely cut at the heart of the very real and necessary protections and liberties that most noble of all documents, the Constitution of these United States, guarantees to all men. If our Creator has imbued us each with the potential to rise above our fears, weaknesses, and judgment of one another, then I say the time is now. Now we must come together, re-examine and redefine ourselves and our nation. We must now commit ourselves to the final measure for which He shall hold in the accounting of our lives here. This is the question. Have we met the needs of the least of those amongst us? Have we? To those who have enthroned themselves and their chosen minions upon the altar of our republic, I say, listen to the people. To those few whose unquenchable thirst for more and more, I say, let the people drink from that cup. To those whose insatiable appetite for wealth and comfort, I say, let the people have an equal place at the table which you spread with the nation's bounty. It is by the labor of the many that the few have unfairly profited from. And remember this, labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor, and could never have existed if labor had not existed first. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration. Therefore, I believe the greed and avarice of those who have and are serving as the people's representatives is a plague upon this nation. We must eradicate this capitalist virus and the plague it has spread across our dear nation. Do not forget these capitalists generally act harmoniously and in concert to fleece the people. Have the great people of this land not given enough already? has their support in blood and disproportionate taxation not given these men I speak of enough? Has not the blood which has flown onto the battlefields of this nation and too many others yet rectified the sins of all our fathers' fathers? For these profound and disturbing reasons, I now call upon all men and women who are in the nation's capital, duly elected by the people to serve the people, to the following course of action. Firstly, to immediately sequester yourselves in those sacred halls of justice and bring the people a just and proper solution now. Working together, bring forth one plan, then another, and another, until the vital and immediate problems at hand are addressed to the benefit of all. Secondly, that every effort and resource of the government be devoted to these things: socially positive and empowering programs and assistance to those who are in great need, to the further growth and expansion of the new frontier in environmentally sound and cost-effective technologies and practices, without limit therein as to the amount of investment necessary. This is our children's future and the planet's hope. And lastly, and most importantly, the very physical and mental well-being of our people. The day has come when my sons were lost to typhoid and other illnesses. I would have given my own life if there was care available to save them. Why then still, in light of this nation's leadership in healthcare and technology and treatment, are too many poor dying in our streets? Members of this national legislature, I proclaim to you, you must make this happen. Otherwise, surely the immediate future and welfare of the people themselves is and will be forever impaired. The many decades of a profit-driven approach to healthcare for all has died. Bury the corpse. If we choose to do these things, we will continue on into the distant future as the bright star of freedom and liberty we were destined to be. So you fathers, in service to your nation, it is your children and their children whom you can at long last and finally now set free. To the sons and daughters of this new generation, though your skin may be black, brown, red, yellow, or white, the wheel of all living things has now turned to your direction. Be brave and compassionate. Help those along this new yet still narrow path to the new territories of the mind to build a new world of dreams I never would have dreamt possible. It is now your right to do right as citizens of this new republic and of the world, to set forth on this journey inspiring each other and your neighbors as to our potential, to find this inspiration in our commonality as one people, to shape the future as we have not yet dreamt it to be. Know this truth: the towering genius disdains a beaten path. It seeks regions hitherto unexplored. So go out into this wide world, all my brothers and sisters. Raise each other to that shared height of greatness we all can find together. And may God bless all the people of this land. And I pray now, dear Father, let this nation become united in the vision of peace and prosperity for all.
And that's Walter Trumbull, Trumbull. Thank you, Walter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
And this has been Michael McCusker and Walter Trumbull. And remember, Saturday is Oregon's 150th birthday. So celebrate. Go kiss somebody in the name of Oregon.